This is a special recording, The Count of Monte Cristo. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service. I will be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Buss. Chapter 22, The Smugglers. Dantes had not been a day on board before he realized the sort of people he was dealing with. Without ever having had lessons from Abbé Faria, the worthy master of the Jeune Amelie, as the Genos Tartan was called, was acquainted with more or less every language spoken around the great lake known as the Mediterranean, from Arabic to Provençal. This relieved him of the need to employ an interpreter, a class of people who are always bothersome and sometimes indiscreet, and made it easy for him to communicate, whether with any ships that he might encounter at sea, or with the little boats that he met along the coasts, or finally with those people without name, nationality, or evident profession who are always to be found on the paved quaysides of seaports, living on mysterious and secret resources which one can only believe must come to them directly from Providence, since they have no other visible means of support. The reader may have guessed that Dantes was on a smuggler's ship. For this reason, the master had been slightly suspicious about taking him on board. He was well known to all the customs officers along the coast, engaging with these gentlemen in a mutual exchange of stratagems, each more cunning than the last. So he had at first thought that Dantes was an emissary of my lord's, the excisemen, who were using this ingenious method to root out some of the secrets of his trade. But the brilliance with which Dantes had succeeded in the rest of fine navigation had entirely convinced him. Then, at the sight of the puff of smoke rising like a plume over the Chateau d'If and the distant sound of the explosion, he momentarily guessed that he had just taken on board one of those men, in this respect like kings, whose entrances and exits are honored by the firing of cannon. This bothered him less, it must be said, than if the newcomer had been a customs officer, and this new suspicion vanished like his predecessor when he saw how perfectly calm his latest recruit remained. In this way, Edmond had the advantage of knowing what his master was, while his master did not know the same about him. Whenever the old seaman and his crew questioned him, and on whatever subject, he held firm and confessed nothing, giving a wealth of details about Naples or Malta, both of which he knew as well as he knew Marseille, and sticking to his first story with a consistency that was a credit to his memory. Thus, the Genoan, wily as he was, let himself be taken in by Edmond, thanks to the young man's gentle manner, his experience of the sea, and above all, his unusual skill at deception. But then, perhaps the Genoan was like those clever men who never know more than they need and believe only what it is in their interest to believe. This was the situation when they arrived at Leghorn. Here, Edmond had to face a new trial. He had to find out if he would recognize himself, not having seen his own face for 14 years. He could remember the young man quite clearly. Now he would discover what he had become as a mature one. As far as his companions were concerned, he had fulfilled his vow. He had already been 20 times to Leghorn and knew a barber in the Rue Saint-Fernand. That was where he went to have his beard shaved and his hair cut. The barber looked with astonishment at this man, with his long hair and thick black beard, who resembled one of those fine heads by Titian. At that time, it was not yet the fashion to wear one's beard and hair long. Nowadays, a barber would rather be surprised that a man who could enjoy such physical attributes should wish to deprive himself of them. He said nothing and set about his work. When it was done, when Edmond felt his chin to be clean shaven, and when his hair had been shortened to normal length, he asked for a mirror and looked in it. Dantès was now 33 years old, as we have said, and his 14 years in prison had brought what might be described as a great spiritual change to his feature. He had entered the Château d'If with the round, full, radiant face of a contented young man whose first steps in life have been easy and who looks to the future as a natural extension of the past. All that had changed utterly. His oval face had lengthened and his once merry lips had adopted a fixed, firm line that spoke of stern resolve. His eyebrows arched under a single pensive line, and his eyes themselves were imprinted with deep sadness, behind which, from time to time, could be seen dark flashes of misanthropy and hatred. His complexion, kept so long from daylight and the sun, had taken on the dull tones that give such aristocratic beauty to men of the North when black hair frames their faces. Moreover, the knowledge that he had acquired gave a look of intelligent self-confidence to his whole face. Though naturally quite tall, his body had taken on the compact vigor of one that has learned to concentrate all its strength within itself. The elegance of lean, nervous limbs had been replaced by the solidity of a well-built, muscular man. His voice, accustomed to prayers, sobs, and curses, had at times a strangely soft resonance, at others a rough edge that was almost husky. In addition, having been constantly in darkness or half light, his eyes had acquired the remarkable ability of seeing in the dark, like those of wolves and hyenas. Edmond smiled when he saw himself. It would have been impossible for his best friend, if he had any friends left, to recognize him. He didn't recognize himself. The master of Jean Amelie, who was very keen to keep someone of Edmond's ability in his crew, had offered him an advance on his share of future profits, and Edmond had accepted. So the first thing he did on leaving the barber's, where he had undergone this preliminary metamorphosis, was to find a shop where he could buy a complete set of seaman's clothes. Of course, this is very simple, consisting of white trousers, a striped shirt, and a Phrygian cap. Edmond returned the trousers and shirt that Jacopi had lent him and appeared in his new dress before the master of the Jeune Amelie, who asked him to repeat his story. The master could hardly recognize the heavily bearded man, half drowned and with seaweed in his hair, whom he had brought naked and dying, onto the deck of his ship, in the smartly dressed and stylish sailor. Encouraged by this change in appearance, he repeated his offer to take Dantès on, but Dantès would accept it for only 3 months. He had plans of his own. The crew of the Jeune Amelie was a very busy one, and subject to a master who was not used to wasting time. They had been hardly a week in Leghorn before the ship's swelling hold was full of colored muslin, forbidden cotton cloth, English powder, and tobacco, on which the state monopoly had forgotten to put its stamp. They had to get all this out of Leghorn, duty paid, and unload it on the Corsican coast, from where certain speculators would take charge of conveying it to France. They set sail, and Edmond found himself once more crossing the azure sea that had been the first horizon of his youth and which he had seen so often in his prison dreams. Leaving the Gorgone on their right and the Pianosa on their left, they set out for the birthplace of Paoli and Napoleon. Coming up on deck early the following day, as was his custom, the master found Dantès leaning against the side of the ship, with a strange look on his face as he stared out towards a heap of granite that the rising sun was bathing in rosy light, the island of Monte Cristo. The Jeune Amelie passed some three quarters of a league to the starboard and continued to make for Corsica. As they sailed past this island, the name of which held such significance for him, Dantes was thinking that he had only to leap into the sea, and with half an hour he would be in this promised land. But what would he do there, with no tools to recover his treasure and no weapons to defend himself? In any case, what would the sailors say? What would the master think? He must wait. Waiting, fortunately, was something that he knew how to do. He had waited 14 years for his freedom. Now that he was free, he could easily wait for 6 months or a year to obtain his wealth. Would he not have chosen freedom without wealth if he had been offered it? In any case, was the wealth not an illusion which had been born in poor Abbé Faria's sick mind and died with him? Yet Cardinal Spada's letter was oddly precise, and Dantes repeated it in his head from beginning to end. He had not forgotten a single word. Evening came. Edmund watched the island pass through all the colors of sunset and dusk, then fade into the darkness for all except himself. His eyes, accustomed to the darkness of a prison cell, doubtless continued to make out the island, since he was the last to leave the deck. The next day they woke up off Illyria. All day they tacked, backwards and forwards, and in the evening bonfires were lit on the shore. The placing of the fires must have shown that it was safe to disembark, because a lantern took the place of the flag on the little shipyard's arm, and they sailed to within gunshot range of the coast. Dantes had noticed that, approaching land on what he must consider solemn occasions, the master of the Jeune Amelie would set up two little culverines on pivots, of the sort that might be used in defending a rampart, and which, without making much noise, would project a quarter-pound shot 1,000 paces. This evening, however, the precaution proved unnecessary. Everything went off as peacefully and as genteelly as might be imagined. Four launches rowed quietly over to the ship, which, no doubt to welcome them, put its own launch in the water. And between them, the five rowing boats had labored so hard that by 2 o'clock in the morning, the whole cargo had been transferred from the Jeune Amelie to dry land. The master of the ship was a man of such well-regulated habits that the very same night the bounty had been divided up. Each man had his share, 100 Tuscan lire, which is about 80 francs in our money. But the voyage was not over. They set course for Sardinia with a view to reloading the vessel that had just been unloaded. The second operation went as smoothly as the first. The Jeune Amelie was in luck. The new cargo was destined for the Duchy of Lucca. It was almost entirely composed of Havana cigars, sherry, and Malaga wine. Here, however, there had a brush with the excise, that eternal enemy of the Jeune Amelie's master. A customs officer was laid low, and two sailors were wounded. Dantes was one of them. A shot passed through his left shoulder, leaving a flesh wound. He was almost happy at the skirmish and his wound. These hard tutors had taught him how he viewed danger and bore suffering. He had laughed at danger, and as the shot pierced him, said like a Greek philosopher, "Pain, you are not an evil." Moreover, he had looked at the mortally wounded customs man, and whether his blood was up or because his feelings were chilled, the sight made very little impression on him. Dantes was on the track that he wished to follow, proceeding towards the end that he wished to attain. His heart was turning to stone in his breast. Jacopo, seeing him fall, had thought him dead and rushed to his side, raised him up, and finally, when he was under cover, tended him like the good friend he was. In short, could it be that the world was neither as good as Dr. Pangloss pretended, nor as bad as it seemed to Dantes, since this man, who had nothing to expect from his friend, except to inherit his part of the bounty, had felt such distress at seeing him fall dead. Happily, as we have said, Dantes was only wounded. With the help of some herbs picked at special times and sold to the smugglers by old Sardinian women, the wound quickly healed. So Edmund wanted to tempt Jacopi as a reward for his care. He offered him his share of the bounty, but Jacopi refused indignantly. As a result of this kind of sympathetic devotion that Jacopi had accorded to Edmond from the first moment they had met, Edmond conceded a certain degree of affection to Jacopi. The latter asked for nothing better. He had perceived in Edmond a great superiority to his present state, something that Edmond had managed to conceal from the others. So the good sailor was satisfied with the little that Edmond gave him. In this way, during the long days on board, when the ship was safely gliding across an azure sea, with a favorable wind swelling its sails and needing no more than the attention of its helmsman, Edmund would take a chart of the coast and make himself Jacopi's instructor, as poor Abbé Faria had become Edmund's. He showed him how to take bearings in coastal waters, explained the compass to him, and taught him to read in that great open book above our heads, which is called the sky, and which God writes on the blue firmament in diamond letters. When Jacopo asked him, "What is the use of teaching all these things to a poor sailor like me?" Edmund replied, "Who knows? One day you may be captain of a ship. Your fellow countryman, Bonaparte, became emperor." We forgot to mention that Jacopo was a Corsican. 2.5 months passed in such successive journeys. Edmund had become as skilled in navigating the coastal waters as he had once been on the open sea. He got to know all the smugglers around the Mediterranean and learned the Masonic signs that these semi-pirates used to recognize one another. 20 times he had sailed one way or the other past his island of Monte Cristo, but not once had he found an opportunity to land there. So he made a resolution, which was that, as soon as his contract with the master of the Jeune Amélie had come to an end, he would hire a little boat on his own account, which he could well do, having saved around 100 piastres on his different voyages, and, on some pretext or another, sail to Monte Cristo. There he would be free to hunt for his treasure. Well, not entirely free, since he would no doubt be spied upon by those who had crossed with him. But in this world, one must learn to take some risks. However, prison had made Edmund cautious, and he would have preferred not to risk anything. Hard though he tried, and fertile though his imagination was, he could not find any other means of reaching the island except to get someone to take him there. Dantes was still racked by doubt when one evening the master, who had great confidence in him and was very anxious to retain his services as a member of the crew, took his arm and led him to a tavern in the Via del Oglio, where the cream of the smuggling profession in Leghorn was accustomed to meet. This is where affairs along the coast were usually discussed. Dantes had already been to this maritime exchange 2 or 3 times, and, at the sight of these bold buccaneers, the product of a coast of some 2,000 leagues in circumference, he had wondered what power a man might yield if his will could manage to direct all these divergent or united threads. This time, an important matter was under discussion. There was a ship loaded with Turkish carpets and cloth from the Levant and the Kashmir. They had to find some neutral ground on which the exchange could take place before bringing these goods to the coast of France. The bounty was so large that, if they were successful, each man should have 50 or 60 piastres. The master of the Jeune Amélie proposed disembarking on the island of Monte Cristo, since it was deserted and there were no soldiers or customs men on it. It seemed to have been set down in the midst of the sea in the days of the pagan Olympus by Mercury. God of tradesmen and thieves, two sorts of people whom we consider separate, if not entirely distinct, but whom antiquity appears to have classed together. At the name of Monte Cristo, Dantes trembled with joy. He got up to hide his emotion and paced round the smoke-filled tavern, in which every dialect of the known world was blended into a single lingua franca. When he returned to the discussion, it had been decided that they would land on Monte Cristo, setting off on this expedition the following night. Edmond was consulted, and he confirmed that the island offered the greatest possible security, and that, if they were to succeed, great enterprises needed to be undertaken promptly. So the plan was adhered to, and it was agreed that they would get underway the following evening, meaning, if they had a calm sea and a favorable wind, that the day after next they would find themselves in the waters off the shore of the neutral island. Chapter 23, The Island of Monte Cristo. At last, by one of those unexpected chances which sometimes happen to people on whom misfortune has exhausted its ingenuity, Dantes was going to reach his goal by a simple, natural means and set foot on his island without arousing any suspicion. Only one night separated him from this long-awaited departure. That night was one of the least restful that Dantes had ever spent. In the course of it, he ran over every good and bad eventuality in his mind. If he closed his eyes, he saw Cardinal Spada's letter, written in blazing letters on the wall. If he fell asleep for a moment, the most insane dreams raced around his skull. He was going down into caves paved with emeralds, with walls of ruby and diamond stalactites. Pearls fell drop by drop in place of the water that habitually filters through the ground. Edmond, frightened, delighted, wondering, filled his pockets with precious stones that clambered up into the daylight, only to find them turned into nothing but ordinary rocks. Then he tried to get back into the marvelous caverns, which he had only glimpsed, but the path twisted into infinite spirals, and the entrance had become invisible. He searched through his tired brain for the mysterious magic word that had opened the wonderful caves of Ali Baba. To the magic word that opened this cave, the Arab fishermen, but all in vain. The vanished treasure had reverted to the ownership of the genii of the earth, from whom he had momentarily hoped to ravish it. Daylight found him almost as feverish as he had been at night, but it also brought logic to assist imagination, and Dantes managed to draw up a plan that had, until now, been only vaguely outlined in his mind. With evening came the preparations for departure. These preparations gave Dantes an opportunity to hide his anxiety. Bit by bit, he had acquired an authority over his companions that allowed him to give orders as though he were the captain of the vessel. And since his orders were always clear, precise, and easy to carry out, the crew obeyed him not only promptly, but with pleasure. The old seaman let him do as he pleased. He, too, had recognized Dante's superiority both to the others and to himself. He saw the young man as his natural successor, and regretted that he did not have a daughter, so that he might bind Edmond to him in that way. At 7 o'clock, all was ready, and at 10 past, they rounded the lighthouse just as it was being lit. The sea was calm, with a fresh wind from the southeast. They were sailing under a clear sky, in which God, too, was progressively putting on his lights, each another world. Dantes announced that everyone could go to bed and that he would take over the helm. When the Maltese, as they called him, made such an announcement, that was enough for everyone, and they all went easily to bed. This sometimes happened from time to time. Dantes, driven out of solitude into the world, felt an imperative need for solitude. And what solitude is more vast and more poetic than that of a ship sailing alone on the sea, in the darkness of night and the silence of infinity, under the eye of the Lord? This time his solitude was peopled with thoughts, the night illuminated by his dreams, and the silence riven with his promises. When the master woke up, the ship was proceeding under full sail. There was not an inch of canvas that was not swollen by the wind. They were traveling at more than 2.5 leagues an hour. The island of Monte Cristo was rising before them on the horizon. Edmond handed the ship back to its owner and went to take his turn in his hammock. Despite a night without sleep, he could not shut his eyes for an instant. 2 hours later, he returned on deck. The ship was just rounding Elba. They were abreast of Marisania and had just passed the flat green island of La Pianosa. The blazing summit of Monte Cristo could be seen, reaching into the heavens. Dantes orders the helmsman to turn to port so that they would leave La Pianosa on their right. He had reckoned that this maneuver would shorten the distance by 2 or 3 knots. Around 5 in the evening, they could see the whole of the island. Every detail of it was clear, thanks to that clarity of the air, which is peculiar to the light of the dying sun. Edmond gazed hungrily on the mass of rocks as they passed through all the colors of sunset, from bright pink to dark blue. From time to time, he flushed warmly. His forehead became congested, and a purple haze crossed before his eyes. No gambler whose whole fortune is staked on a single roll of the dice has ever experienced the agony that Edmond did in his paroxysms of hope. Night fell. At 10 o'clock, they dropped anchor. The Jeune Amélie was the first to reach the rendezvous. Despite his usual self-control, Dantes could not contain himself. He was the first to leap on shore, and if he had dared, he would have kissed the soil like Brutus. It was pitch black, but at 11 o'clock the moon rose over the sea, throwing a silver light on every crest. Then, as it rose higher, its rays began to tumble in white cascades of light over the piled rocks of this other Pelion. The crew of the Jeune Amélie were familiar with the island. It was one of their usual points of call. Dantes, on the other hand, had recognized it from each of his voyages to the Near East, but he had never stopped off there. He questioned Jacopo, "Where are we going to spend the night?" "On board, of course," the sailor replied. "Wouldn't we be better in the caves?" "What caves?" "The ones on the island." "I don't know any caves," Jacopo said. A cold sweat broke out on Dantes' forehead. "There are no caves on Monte Cristo?" he asked. "No." For a moment he was stunned. Then he thought that the caves might have been filled in by some accident or even been blocked by Cardinal Spada himself as an extra precaution. The main thing in that case would be to find the lost entrance. There was no point in looking at night, so Dantes put off his search until the next day. In any case, a signal displayed by a boat some half a league out to sea, to which the Jeune Amélie responded immediately with the same, showed that the time had come to set to work. The second ship, reassured by the signal, which told the late arrival that it was safe to make land, soon appeared, white and silent as a ghost, and dropped anchor a cable's length from the shore. The transfer of goods began immediately. As he worked, Dantes thought of the shout of joy that he could have brought from all these men with a single word if he had spoken aloud the thought that hummed incessantly in his ears and in his heart. But far from revealing the marvelous secret, he was already afraid he might have said too much, or that, By his coming and going, his repeated questions, his minute observations, and his constant preoccupation, he might have aroused some suspicion. It was fortunate, at least in these circumstances, that an unhappy past had stamped his features with an indelible air of sadness, and that one could perceive only brief flashes of the lights of merriment hovering beneath this cloud. No one suspected anything, and when the next day Dantes took a gun, some shot and powder, and said he would like to go and shoot one or two of the wild goats that could be seen leaping from rock to rock, his expedition was ascribed purely to love of hunting and a desire for solitude. Only Jacopo insisted on following him. Dantes did not want to object, fearing that any reluctance to take a companion with him might awaken suspicion. But they had gone hardly a quarter of a league when, seizing the opportunity to shoot a kid, he told Jacopo to take it back to the crew, suggesting that they should cook it, then signal to him when it was ready for him to share by firing a shot. Some dry fruit and a flagon of Montepulciano would complete the meal. Dantes continued, turning from time to time. Reaching the summit of a rock, he saw his companions 1,000 feet below him. Jacopo had just joined them, and they were already engaged in preparing a dinner, which, thanks to Edmund's skill, now had a main dish. He watched them for a moment with a sad, gentle smile of superiority. In 2 hours, he said, these men will leave, richer by 50 piastres, and proceed to risk their lives to gain 50 more. Finally, when they have 600 livres, they will go and squander this fortune in some town or another, as proud as sultans and as arrogant as nabobs. Today, hope means that I despise their wealth, which seems to me like the most abject poverty. Tomorrow, perhaps, disappointment may mean that I shall be forced to consider that abject poverty as the height of happiness. Oh, no, he cried, it cannot be. The wise, the infallible Faria could not have been mistaken on this one point. In any event, better to die than to go on living this sordid and base existence. So Dantes, who 3 months earlier had wanted nothing except freedom, felt already not free enough, but wanted wealth. It was not the fault of Dantes, but of God, who, while limiting the power of man, had created in him infinite desires. Meanwhile, Dantes had approached a place where he supposed the caves to be situated. Going along a road hidden between two walls of rock and down a path cut by the torrent, which, in all likelihood, no human foot had ever trodden. Following the line of the shore and examining everything minutely, he thought he could see on certain rocks marks which had been made by human hands. Time casts its muddy mantle over physical objects and a mantle of forgetfulness on non-physical ones, and it seemed to have respected these marks, made with some regularity, probably with the aim of tracing a route, but occasionally they disappeared under great bunches of myrtle, heavy with flowers, or under clinging lichens. Edmund would then have to push aside the branches or lift the moss to discover the clues that led him into this new labyrinth. In any case, these marks had given Edmund hope. Why should it not be the cardinal who had made them, so that, in the event of some misfortune, which he could not have imagined so absolute, they could serve to guide his nephew? This solitary place seemed designed for a man who wished to hide a treasure. But could these treacherous marks have attracted eyes other than those for which they were intended? Had the dark and wonderful island guarded its marvelous secret faithfully? Arriving at a point only about 60 yards from the port, but still hidden from his companions by the rocks, Edmunds thought that the scratches had come to an end. But they did not lead to any kind of cave. The only point to which they seemed to direct him was a large round rock, settled on a solid base. Edmund thought, instead of having reached the end of the trail, he might, on the contrary, be only at the beginning. So he decided to take the opposite course and retrace his steps. Meanwhile, his companions had been preparing dinner, getting water from the spring, carrying bread and fruit ashore, and cooking the kid. Just as they were taking it off its improvised spit, they saw Edmund leaping from rock to rock, as light and daring as a chamois. So they fired a shot as a signal to him. The huntsman immediately changed direction and ran back to them. But just as they were all watching him as he leapt through the air and accusing him of pushing his skill beyond the limits of caution, as if to justify their fears, Edmund lost his footing. They saw him totter on the peak of the rock, cry out, and disappear. All of them dashed forward at once because they were all fond of Edmund, despite his superiority. But it was Jacopo who arrived first. He found Edmund lying on the ground, covered in blood and almost unconscious. He must have tumbled from a height of 12 to 15 feet. They put a few drops of rum in his mouth, and this medicine, which had already proved so effective with him, had the same result the second time. Edmund reopened his eyes, complained of a sharp pain in the knee, a great weight on his head, and an unbearable stabbing in the small of his back. They tried to carry him to the beach, but when they touched him, even though Jacopo was directing operations, he groaned and said that he did not feel strong enough to be moved. Of course, there was no question of him taking food, but he insisted that the others, not having the same reason as he did to fast, should go back to their dinner. For himself, he declared that he only needed a little rest and that he would find him better when they returned. Old sea dogs do not stand on ceremony. The sailors were hungry, and the smell of kid was wafting up to them. So they did not wait to be asked twice. An hour later, they returned. All that Edmund had managed to do was to drag himself about 10 yards so that he was leaning against the mossy rock. But the pain, instead of lessening, actually seemed to have increased. The old master, who was obliged to leave that morning so that he could put off his cargo on the frontier of France and Piedmont between Nice and Fréjus, insisted that Dantès try to get up. Dantès made a superhuman effort to comply, but every time fell back, pale and groaning. "His back is broken," the master whispered. "No matter. He's a good comrade, and we can't abandon him. Let's try to carry him to the tartan." But Dantès announced that he would rather die where he was than suffer the terrible pain that he felt at the slightest movement. "Well then," said the master, "whatever happens, it will not be said that we left a good comrade like yourself without help. We'll delay our departure until this evening." This suggestion astonished the sailors, though none of them opposed it. On the contrary, the master was a man of such rigid ideas that this was the first time they had seen him give up a project or even delay it. But Dantès did not want such a serious breach of the ship's rules to be made on his behalf. "No, no," he told the master. "I was clumsy, and it is right that I should suffer for my own carelessness. Leave me a small supply of biscuits, a gun, powder and shot to kill goats, or even to defend myself, and a pickaxe, so that I can build some kind of house in case you are too long in returning to fetch me." "You will starve," said the master. "Better that," Edmund answered, "than to suffer the unspeakable pain that I feel at the slightest movement." The master turned to look at the ship, swaying at anchor in the little harbor with the sails partly set, ready to head out to sea as soon as the rest of the canvas had been raised. "What can we do, Maltese?" he said. "We cannot abandon you here, but we can't stay either." "Leave, leave," Dantès cried. "We'll be gone for at least a week, and even then we shall have to turn off course to pick you up." "Listen," said Dantès, "if 2 or 3 days from now you meet some fishing boat or other that is sailing near here, let them know about me, and I shall pay them 25 piastres to take me back to Leghorn. If you don't pass any such vessel, then come back yourself. The master shook his head. Listen, Monsieur Baldi, Jacopo told the master, there's a way to settle all of this. You leave, and I'll stay with the patient and take care of him. Would you give up your share of the bounty, Edmond said, to stay with me? Willingly. You are a fine lad, Jacopo, said Edmond. God will reward you for your goodwill. But I don't need anyone, thank you. In a day or two I shall be rested, and I expect to find some excellent herbs in these rocks, which will cure my wounds. A strange smile passed over Dante's face, and he took Jacopo's hand warmly. But he was unshaken in his resolve to remain, and to remain alone. The smugglers left Edmond what he wanted and walked off, looking back several times and warmly waving goodbye. Edmond replied with only one hand, as though he could not move the rest of his body. Then, when they had gone, he muttered with a laugh, "It's strange that one should find such proof of affection and acts of devotion among men of that kind." At this, he cautiously dragged himself to the top of a rock that lay between him and the sea. From there, he could see the tartan completing its preparations, raising anchor, hovering elegantly, like a seagull about to take flight, and setting sail. An hour later, it had completely disappeared, at least from the place where the wounded man was lying, and had vanished from sight. Then Dantes got up, lighter and more supple than one of the goats that prance around among the gum trees and myrtle bushes on these savage rocks, took his gun in one hand and his pick in the other, and ran to the rock, which represented the end of the trail of notches that he had followed. "And now," he shouted, recalling the story about the Arab fisherman that Faria had told him, "and now, open sesame." We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated by Robin Buss. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is NorthCarolinaReadingService.org, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.